The Collective Laboratory.
Mudam.
The Collective Laboratory est un projet développé par Lina Jeanne et Clémentine Proby au Mudam, le musée d'art contemporain du Luxembourg, de novembre 2023 à janvier 2024, pour aborder, questionner et repenser pratiques artistiques collectives et méthodologies institutionnelles. 6 collectifs européens, évoluant dans les champs de l'édition et de la performance, ont été invités à occuper les espaces d'exposition du musée, les transformant temporairement en résidences d'artistes. Le temps de 2 semaines, leurs membres ont fait des galeries vides leur espace de production, de répétition et d'expérimentation. Dans le cadre de ce projet, Théo Robin Langlois réalise un format radiophonique pour Du Radio en 6 épisodes.
So, I've seen mugwort, which is this plant in Latin. The Latin name is Artemisia vulgaris, and it's linked to the moon, the Artemis from ancient Greece. Okay. And it's this amazing plant that induces dreams in people, so it has a psychotropic characteristic that when it's consumed in higher doses, it alters your dream states. So it's this amazing plant, and it's also like got this long legacy related to the witch period. That in again in high doses, it can be used as an abortifacient. So it was used by midwives in the Dark Ages and beyond to induce abortions in people. You can take it as an infusion, you can also cook with it. I know that in parts of China they cook it like spinach, so it's a different variety. And then there's also rose hip, which is in season now, which is the big red berry. It's part of the rose family, and that's really, really medicinal for the heart. You can make jam from this, you can make drinks from like a syrup. It's also a aphrodisiac, yeah.
We are Gobi Fish, but it's made up of me, Maya Magoga.
I'm Alia Hamoui.
And we also have Fenella Brereton, who's the third member. We were like looking at different symbioses within nature, and we stumbled upon this very cute story, which we've like coined the symbiotic love story, where the shrimp that is blind builds a hole while the fish looks out for predators. So they have this like mutualistic exchange. And so we reduced it to Gobi Fish. We have worked in various spaces, and I guess over the last like 2 years, the majority has been in community garden spaces.
I feel like the way London has influenced our practice, well, personally, it's just there's so many different cultures in London, and I'm half Lebanese, and there's a big Lebanese community in Lebanon, and a lot of the ways we kind of connect to home is through that. So I think it's a reminder of the vital role food plays within kind of this idea of movement and migration. And I think for me, I find that really interesting. I also, we were reading this text called On Transparency, and she talks about this idea of, living within the smog as a political point, a political framing. And I think because we're talking about these conversations about not reconnecting to nature, but reframing or reminding us to think about nature, I think it's really important to do that from this perspective of urban spaces as well, because that is the reality most of us live in, and not to kind of fall into like a utopic framework. It's like, what are we in? This is where we are at now, and how can we slightly, small shifts and incremental shifts into thinking about things in a slightly different way. So I find it interesting to work from the urban space.
We do like a yearly summer solstice feast where we feed like 80 people and everything is cooked on the open fire.
Yeah, also to the community garden thing, I think in where we are in London, a lot of people I didn't know before we found that garden, and it's 5 minute cycle from my house. There's all these little nooks and crannies of spaces that are doing all these amazing stuff. So it's kind of I think for the event we did last year was called Songs of the Chickweeds, because we kind of wanted to think about the idea that even within urban spaces, you can think about our connection to the green in quite radical ways. So the chickweed is a plant that grows typically in damp places by fence posts or between the cracks of concretes, etc. So I think sometimes I see the kind of events that we do in London as a kind of a form of a weed.
A big part of our practice is this feeling of like speculation, of looking simultaneously to the past, like looking to ancient techniques, looking to how our ancestors would have worked with food, how they would have preserved food, but also thinking, you know, like in a future-oriented way as well. And I think by, I don't know, inhabiting spaces that aren't usually inhabited by large groups of people, especially large groups of young people, I don't think we're used to gathering in those sorts of ways, where the central focus isn't like alcohol, or not that we're anti-alcohol, but like it's nice to shift the focus, I think. It's nice to have a space where it's like you're gathered around a fire and you're eating food with strangers that you haven't met before. So yeah, this feels really nourishing, I think.
We are vapor, we are water, muslin, hemp, silk, honey, wax, leaves. We are also plastic, oil, pollution, radiation. The atmosphere is not perfectly visible, rather mediated by strata of toxins, carbons, microbes, particulate matter, smoke, clouds, sulfur, dust, mist, fog, haze, seeds, pollen, doubt, mirages.
I guess it's like framing the compost as the perfect meeting point between death and life, because it's literally, I don't know, it's like this incredible portal where it's the end of a life cycle, but through the transformation of the organic matter, it becomes fertile matter. It becomes what soil is like in need of. And another material we've been working at, looking similarly at like the image of the snake eating its tail, like that point, is ash as well.
Well, yeah, the ash was, we were planning to do this, but we actually haven't got around to it, to make like lye cookies, which is it's in the Greek tradition, which you mix the ash with the water and you create like a lye solution. And then you can use this as a substitute for like a rising agent in the cookies.
We're going to use the shell, and we'll do this after the demo step, to take the white away. So you just drop it like this until there's no white. And then you'll have a cup of salt.
Do that before.
So you're putting like just a thin layer, so enough to coat the bottom. And then you drop it in, hopefully without breaking it. Yep. And then I'll use this. You just want like a centimeter, so it's like covered by a centimeter all round. It's a very, very simple technique. And then yeah, but cover it a bit more.
We had beetroots that we wrapped in the clay technique. We've preserved black radishes in wax. We made various like ferments, like carrot ferment, lacto ferment, where you just add a salt brine. Kombucha with different types of teas and spices.
Squash ferment?
Squash ferment as well. I think those are the preserves and the carrots, yeah.
We're using bread mainly to make votives, using bread as kind of almost like a clay that we sculpt into different shapes and then we'll bake and they just become really solid. So we were looking a lot at like the ritualistic practice of votives, in which you make something that you want to heal or something you want to offer traditionally to a deity, but kind of reutilizing that framework a bit differently.
Thank you.
magasin un jour, en fait.
Yeah, so for our final event, which will be a performance on Saturday, we've like reinterpreted this idea of death rituals by looking at the symbology of the yew tree, which is this kind of granddad of a tree, in the sense that the oldest tree is maybe 9,000 years old, which is one of the oldest trees known. And the way that it regenerates is that the inside of the tree dies, but the outside remains, so it can constantly regenerate. And we just looked into the kind of different folklore and mythology of the tree and found it to be so abundant with, yeah, insight and like little kind of ways to frame our practice in this final performance. Like the fact that it's highly toxic, but also has medicinal value. So this kind of paradox of it being, yeah, a poison, but also like a saving ailment. There's so many things about the yew tree, like when it's really hot, it releases a kind of sap that when you smell it, it can induce hallucinations. So like shamanically, it was used a lot by like druid people historically. And yeah, there's just loads of like folk tales of people being kind of brought in by goblins, and they would go missing, and then they would be found like years later dancing around the yew tree with the goblins. So it's got this very mystical position in history. And yeah, we just thought it was a really interesting, like, yeah, framing of the work we've been doing. This project has not risen in isolation at all. I think there's like a very interesting movement of more and more artists working with food, maybe in the last like 7 years. Obviously this is again like, this has been, that there's been artists who've worked with food in the past, but I think there was a long period of like, yeah, it didn't happen so much.
Yeah, a bit of a revival of it.
A bit of a revival, for sure. So people like Lexi Smith, who works with bread, like bread is her medium for storytelling, for, yeah, recounting political conversations. And another artist, Inés de Santos, who was like a big part of the reason why I became interested in food and art pollination in the first place.
I think recently we've been looking at Jemana Manna's work quite a lot. So she's a Palestinian artist and really thinks about the connection of food to land, how that's been politicized, controlled, etc. So one of her videos, Forages, we've been watching. Sean Roy Parker, he comes to some of our events in London, and he's a really interesting practitioner. I think just in general, our practice is interested in food, like both as a material, but also as a metaphor, and how that can operate within a social, an ecological, or in a political dimension. And that kind of varies from project to project. But yeah, I think for us, food is both content and metaphor. Yeah.
I guess also the kind of power of food historically to build community and to like form relationships is something that's very, very visible and very present in a lot of political movements through time. And I see that presently, like I'm someone that's worked a lot in community spaces, and food is such an incredible tool that just like allows for certain boundaries to collapse where people can feel comfortable, and it just creates this amazing space for connection. And I think that there are so many possible avenues with food to, yeah, form community, but also to like literally fuel revolution through people's survival, especially when the state is like disenfranchising entire communities of people, not allowing them access to like good, healthy food. So food is inherently this incredibly political thing.
Yeah, and like things such as foraging, the act of like foraging, especially, you know, we do that sometimes in the urban space of London. It's a way to kind of use up the systems in which we are encouraged to not engage, but like kind of food as a commodity, food something we buy from a supermarket, food that feels very detached from our natural environment. So kind of using these different forms of collecting, such as foraging, etc., to like encourage to think about how we can recalibrate our understanding of how we eat, how we consume.
Yeah. There's such a huge amount of knowledge that has been erased through the onset of colonialism, through this kind of like separation of bodies to landscapes. And I think a big part of our practice is this kind of intrigue in, it's not this idea of like reconnecting, but it's reestablishing connection to people's landscapes, which we have inherently in us. It's just like relearning the knowledge of plants, their medicinal purposes. I think there's so much that can happen through this like deepening of, yeah, just knowing where you're situated, basically. Food has historically been weaponized. Like, it's not just a tool for bringing people together. It's also a tool for segregation. It's also a tool that's used in apartheid, as we're witnessing in Palestine right now. And I think I went to an exhibition in London a few months ago. It's not really this specifically, but it was looking at the far right in America and how their symbol for white nationalism has become milk. So it's like the symbol of the milk was like, became this like weird Nazi logo suddenly. So I think there's so many, yeah, there's so many examples of this. Like, to go more into the Palestine example, foraging has been made illegal by the Israeli state in occupied states in Palestine. So they wouldn't be able to forage things like za'atar and something called akub, which is a kind of wild artichoke. And this is their livelihood. This is their way of survival. This is their way of making money. And the crazy thing is that Israeli authorities would make this practice illegal while then domesticating the wild plant to resell to Arab communities.
On the basis that za'atar was an endangered species, but it's not. It's like, you know, and it needs to be like with the akub, especially, like you need to, if you pick it, it's what allows it to, in wild spaces, it's what allows it to like keep growing and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Basically changing, kind of co-opting the landscape and politicizing.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many examples of this. Like, you can talk about the food deserts in Detroit and how, like, marginalized, especially brown and black communities, have been placed in food deserts. So they have to drive, what, like an hour and a half away from where they live to access any kind of food, which is often, like, processed foods. So I think, yeah, the weaponization of food is something that is historical and
also just what like global politics is built on. Like, we look at Ukraine with the wheat. I was talking to someone the other day about in Egypt about how the IMF encouraged Egypt by saying that they would wipe off their loans if they stopped growing wheat and started growing other things like strawberries. They would wipe their loans off, but then it meant that Egypt was reliant on other countries such as America to import wheat. So they become beholden to American power. So, like, yeah, food is, like, predominantly one of the major players in how we control and co-op spaces.
And with, like, Monsanto as well, like, how they, yeah, disallowed certain seed varieties from being used. So the ancient practice of saving seed was now, like, illegal or whatever, and they had to buy the Monsanto stamp seed, which is, yeah, chemically induced, and you can't save the seed from it. So it's just, yeah, it's endless. It's endless, this tool, this state oppressive tool. Yeah.